Hey, everyone out there, and thanks for joining us again here at ASAP Nowcast, the podcast for ASAP Now. For those of you joining us again, welcome back. And for those of you joining us for the very first time, welcome. Every month, we feature an article from the magazine or podcast-only feature of a topic covering the latest in emergency medicine. It's been a little bit since we took it back to core clinical content, so that's what we're doing this month. Now, when it comes to clinical content, the magazine often covers the latest studies or practices and disease processes in emergency medicine so that our practice can evolve with the times. But there's actually a good chunk of practice that is fairly static, but that you just have to know like the back of your hand. Our feature this month is that for me, neonatal resuscitation. What do you do when there is precipitous delivery? And now not only do you have two patients in mom and baby, but a crashing brand new baby. These are the sort of case scenarios that give me palpitations, but also what makes our training so special. So this month, we got to meet with the authors of our article, Neonatal Resuscitation Tips, available in the print magazine and online at asapnow.com. Hey everyone, and thank you for joining us this month on ASAP Now's Nowcast. We have two really special authors with us, Dr. Matt Turner, who is an EM resident at Hershey Medical Center, and also Dr. Steve Sandelich, who is a PEM physician at Hershey Medical Center, here to talk to us about one of the core topics in emergency medicine, but one that we don't usually see a whole lot, especially since a lot of us are in primarily adult practice, and that is neonatal resuscitation. So Matt and Steve, I want to say thank you guys so much for joining us today.
Of course. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, we really appreciate being able to talk to y'all.
Now, so this article really caught my eye because I like to cover something core periodically on the podcast, like core clinical. And to me, neonatal resuscitation is definitely that. But it's something that, I mean, I was telling Matt before this, you know, it's probably been about 5 years since I have seen a really sick, you know, neonatal baby from an unexpected delivery in the ER. So I wanted to open with kind of getting you guys' thoughts. What made you think to go and do this review?
Yeah, well, speaking from the resident perspective, definitely neonatal resuscitation, that is one of like the really sphincter tightening experiences. That's the type of thing that you wake up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat being really worried about this sort of scenario, which is really the reason that Dr. Sandelich and I decided to write this paper. I think that the algorithm itself is surprisingly straightforward. It's just that it's highly important to be up to date on it and to practice it regularly just due to the sheer amount of stress involved.
Yeah, no kidding. I would love to jump right in with that because I agree with you. It's like this thing that you just have to be able to spit out at any moment, even though we don't do it super often. So let's I guess, jump in. I think you guys structure the article really well, which is called Neonatal Resuscitation Tips, which is, again, in the current month's ASAP Now magazine. But walk me through, what are the initial assessments and steps?
Of course.
One of the first things I always keep in mind is most babies are going to be fine. While births in the emergency departments are scary, most of the time, kids are going to be totally fine. People have been giving birth for a long time, and there are relatively few complications for the most part in a healthy baby. Ideally, we'll be able to have predictions on which ones are going to cause problems. But for the most part, if mom does end up giving birth to the emergency department, that first step in the algorithm, term gestation, good tone, and you're breathing and crying, if that kid looks good, you don't need to do much. You don't need to be clamping the cord immediately. You don't need to be doing a lot of interventions. You give the baby to mom, and that's pretty much it for the most part.
Let nature do its thing.
Exactly. We can talk about like delayed cord clamping is a great thing. But you just plop mom right on baby, and everyone for the most part does good. Only about 10% of kids are going to need something, and only about 1% are going to need something more invasive. Maybe Matt, if you want to kind of run through some of the more invasive stuff after the happy, healthy baby.
Yep. Yes, sir. Absolutely. So like Dr. Sandelich was saying, 90% of the time, no intervention required, baby's going to be fine. But then there's the 10% that will require at least some sort of intervention. So within the first 30 seconds, if the baby has any sort of evidence of apnea, cyanosis, difficulty breathing, anything like that, we want to have a warmer available so that we can take the patient to the warmer, maintain a good temperature between 36.5 and 37.5, provide tactile stimulation through drying and rubbing, and reposition the airway. Now, after 30 seconds of that, so 1 minute from the birth, we want to reassess the neonate. So this is the most important step. If the patient's heart rate is below 100, or if they are apneic and gasping, we need to initiate positive pressure ventilation. Like I said, easily the most important step of the entire algorithm. So we should start PPV with a peak inspiratory pressure of 20 to 25 and an end expiratory pressure of 5. Typically, if they're a term, they should have an FiO2 of 0.21, while preterm should have an FiO2 between 0.21 and 0.3. Now, within these first 15 seconds of initiating PPV, if possible, we should also obtain an EKG. Now, sometimes this can be difficult. Wiggly baby, there might be some secretions and fluid. It could be difficult to get the leads on, but it's still pretty important to allow us to really auscultate and follow their heart rate. So within the next 15 seconds after we've initiated PPV, we should reassess the patient. If the heart rate is increasing, that is a good sign. Continue with the PPV. However, if there is no change or if the heart rate is still under 100, we need to readjust the PPV. Now, fortunately, there's an easy way to readjust PPV with the Mr. SOPA mnemonic. Walking through it, it goes M, reapply the mask. Make sure that there's no leakage with the mask, no evidence that the mask is applied incorrectly. R, we need to reposition the infant's head. Typically, the best position for the infant is with the neck slightly extended. It is common for people to hyperextend the neck or underextend the neck. It should be slightly extended with the shoulders just above the bed. After we do these first two steps, we should give several breaths with the PPV and then auscultate the patient's heart rate. If the heart rate is still below 100, we continue with the rest of the SOPA mnemonic. So S, suction the airway. O, open the mouth further. P, increase the peak inspiratory pressure. And A, provide an alternate airway, possibly an LMA. So after another 30 seconds, we reassess. And this is where we have another branch point that could go three ways. If the heart rate is now above 100, we continue the PPV at 40 to 60 breaths per minute until spontaneous breathing starts. If the heart rate is from 60 to 99, then we go through Mr. SOPA again to ensure maximum effectiveness. We should note that 2/3 of cases of continued depression after intervention has begun is due to improper PPV. So if the PPV isn't working, it's probably an issue on the physician's side, not baby side. And then if the heart rate is below 60, we will need to escalate the patient's care to the more advanced resuscitation algorithm.
And Matt, you can probably go into that if you don't mind. Like I'm assuming you mean medications, right?
Yes, exactly. So the advanced resuscitation algorithm is more like the ACLS sort of pathway that we're all more familiar with as ED physicians. So really for this, it always begins with a secured airway, which should typically be done first with an ET tube if possible. This is because when you're doing chest compressions, especially on a neonate, it can make it a lot more difficult to actually get a fixed airway. So typically a good rule of thumb for ET tubes, if the patient is less than 1,000 grams, we'll use a 2.5 millimeter ET tube. If they're 1,000 to 2,000 grams, we can use a 3.0 tube. And if they're over 2,000 grams, we could use a 3.5 ET tube. If we aren't able to obtain any sort of tube intubation, we can also use an LMA mask. Once we have a secured airway, we will start with chest compressions. This is the way that you learn in most CPR classes with the two-thumb technique, wrapping your hands around the chest and compressing the sternum with both thumbs. Typically, once the airway has been secured, you want the person doing compressions to actually do it from the head of the patient. And we give three compressions for every one ventilation. So a good way to pace yourself through this is the one and two and three and breathe and one and two and three and breathe with 90 compressions and 30 breaths per minute. While we are doing these chest compressions, we need to also establish some sort of IV access. If possible, an umbilical vein catheter would be great, but sometimes this can be very difficult to achieve and an IO is also more than appropriate. So once we have access, we can start administering medications. And really, in this case, there's only two meds that you really need. Epinephrine, which you can give every 3 to 5 minutes if the heart rate continues to be below 60, and normal saline, which you can give at a 10 cc per kilogram bolus for any concerns of hypovolemia. And at that point, you continue to run through your advanced resuscitation pathway until you can either restore proper heart rate or the situation changes.
Now, that's a really helpful review because it sounds so clear when you detail it like that. And I think in reality, you know, we're aware that this is a highly resource-intensive resuscitation, right? There's probably a whole team dealing with whatever's going on with mom. And there is, of course, a whole team, including RT, nursing, you know, someone documenting, obviously the physician, et cetera, maybe like a proceduralist, like especially if you're at a residency program where someone will come do airway, someone else is running the code. So I love Mr. Sopa for sure. I would love to hear if there's any other quick pearls for us to remember. Like my takeaway on this is always bradycardia is bad. Breathe the baby. If things are not going well after about 2 minutes, then, you know, you need to probably be giving medicines. Like that's kind of my really reductive way of putting it. But again, you know, mostly an adult doctor, I don't see these as much. Any thoughts for either of you, Dr. Sandlich, Dr. Turner, on the takeaways, pearls that we can just call on when we are really stressed and feeling all the adrenaline trying to run one of these?
Yeah, of course. And this always is easier to do just as a discussion than different when the baby, the apneic baby is in front of you, of course. Preparation and ventilation are the things that I always think about. So if you have any type of prep time from your EMS command call, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, anything, assemble your team, go through the algorithm, review it. Those 1 minute marks, those 30 second marks, they go very, very fast. So review that algorithm, even in just that couple seconds that you have before, make sure you have all the equipment available that you need. Make sure that you have debriefed your team as much as possible so everyone's on the same page. Again, these are kind of high-risk situations that happen very rarely that people don't often deal with. Heck, even in the pediatric emergency departments, we don't often deal with these type of things. Whenever I get these in, I always, if I have the chance, review that algorithm right before we're going to run in. And then brief your team, go through what you're thinking, what medications you're going to want, what type of equipment you're going to need. Go through everything that you're thinking of with your team so everyone's on the same page. And then when that kid gets there, most badness happens because of issues with ventilation. Sure, you have some cardiac issues, you have some metabolic issues, but most neonatal resuscitation has a problem with ventilation and is fixed with ventilation. So trying to get that good mask fit, trying to get that good positive pressure ventilation is going to fix most of your issues, and most of that algorithm is going to address ventilation.
Yeah, and I love what you said about preparation. I think it's worth mentioning because, you know, this could happen at any emergency department. So I think what I've seen that's really effective is that there is a neonatal cart or, you know, or packet of some kind along with the warmer. And on it is actually a printed out algorithm because it's just something that's so rare. Like grab the packet, grab the cart, everyone review it before the patient gets there if you have time. And then reference it as needed, including, you know, like the ET tube sizes, like the medication doses of epi, et cetera, because they're just not top of mind for certainly for non-pediatric emergency physicians, because we just don't see it enough. So I like how you break that up quite a bit. Now, one thing you guys mentioned in the article that I thought was interesting was that after your resuscitative efforts are successful, that when the patient is being transferred, they obviously need an ICU, but they may be undergoing therapeutic hypothermia. And I wanted to highlight that because in the adult world, there's certainly a lot of literature talking about is hypothermia even effective. So I would love to hear the opinion coming out of pediatric emergency medicine, pediatric critical care on that particular topic, just really briefly, because I thought it was an interesting one you mentioned.
During the initial resuscitation efforts, it's very important to actually expressly avoid hypothermia. Particularly preterm babies can be at significant risk for this. Oftentimes it can be helpful just to actually wrap them in plastic before you actually initiate any of the resuscitative measures, just to ensure that they continue to have that proper temperature, usually between 36.5 and 37.5 degrees Celsius. In regards to ultimate dispo with hypothermia after the resuscitative efforts have been complete, I believe Dr. Sandlich has more experience with this than me.
So therapeutic hypothermia certainly does have a place in the care of post-resuscitative neonates. The exact protocols are somewhat outside of the scope of this discussion. However, if your neonate has gone through extensive resuscitative efforts and appears to be requiring further resuscitative efforts, for example, the kids that have required multiple doses of epinephrine that are intubated, anyone you're concerned for hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy, then hypothermia should be at least considered. And that should make be a part of your decision in your disposition process for what neonatal intensive care unit you're planning on sending these patients to. For the most part, if you do have that patient that is, you have concerns for HIE and has required significant interventions, then a neonatal intensive care unit at one of the pediatric tertiary care facilities is usually going to be the appropriate disposition for those kids.
Yep. And that totally makes sense and helpful because most of us, will end up transferring these kids, terrifying as it seems, to send an intubated newborn somewhere. Now, lastly, the last topic I want to talk about is I think resuscitations are always traumatic. I think this is a uniquely traumatic resuscitation for the staff or the mother, I'm sure for the baby as well. And I wanted to get your thoughts, probably Dr. Sandlich, because you've done more of these than most of us had. How do you handle this? I think pediatric resuscitation is already very tragic. I think a neonatal one can only be, can only feel worse. Like, what do you do for staff morale? What do you do to educate the mother? Like, what do you do to try to feel like there is, some calm? And I mean, honestly, like I would have PTSD after one of these. Like, even if it went well, I feel like that's something that would just, brew on me for a long time. What are your thoughts on that?
And it is extremely difficult. These are some of the hardest cases that you run into in the pediatric emergency medicine world. I guess the bright side is that most cases do go well. Most kids don't need a lot of efforts, and most of the time they recover well and are able to be resuscitated. In the cases where they do not go well and you have bad outcomes, you have those concerns for HIE, you have kids that are intubated in critical condition, or the ones that unfortunately do not make it and expire, then having that conversation with both your staff and the family is extremely difficult. In regards to talking with the family, again, there's no right way to do it. These are going to be horrible conversations. And I find that in those situations, just getting out and saying, unfortunately, we have done everything that we can, your child has died. And not having euphemisms, not having any other words, just saying it out. And honestly, parents are not going to hear anything else after that, regardless of what you say. So honestly, I would just get out there and say what you need to say and let them process in whatever way they need to process. That mom also just went through a very intense physiologic process, giving birth, and then having this incredible emotional process on top of that is almost incomprehensible. Every person is going to process that differently, and it's not your job to tell them how to process it. It's just our job to help them through that in whatever way we can. From a staff perspective, that is also very difficult. These are rare events that can be traumatic on staff in a very intense way. I find kind of going back to that preparation is also helpful. Letting people know kind of what's going on, getting everyone in the same mental headspace. When you have a code that is run well, it is easier for the staff to deal with it often after, as opposed to those codes that are all over the place, that no one feels like anything is under control, that everyone feels like they're yelling at things. When you have codes that are run kind of more calmly and more direct, it's often easier for things to be processed after. I often find that a debrief directly after these episodes is incredibly helpful. There is a space for debriefing remotely a period of time away from the incident, but for these type of incidents where it's very, very stressful, I find that after we get everything done as much as we can from a medical standpoint, just pulling all my staff into a spare room and just giving everyone a safe space to talk. Everyone is going to process differently. And oftentimes what I'll do is just give a brief outline of what I think happened from a medical standpoint, and then just ask if anyone has anything to say, if anyone has anything they want to express, and just stop talking. And oftentimes the things that staff will bring up and the things that they have to say are quite impactful, and that's honestly the start of that healing process, and the process of them getting through it is just talking about it often, if that is their one of their coping mechanisms. But just giving them the opportunity to be able to do that, I found is incredibly helpful.
Yeah, and I like that explanation because a lot of it is not that different from any other resuscitation. Like we tried, you know, for patients, right? In any certainly death conversation, you know, we try to be direct so that there's no confusion. Like we know that what comes after that will likely be not heard by the family. And that's not so different, you know, from any other resuscitation. Similarly, like debriefs is something we do after many resuscitations. I really like the part where I think you're really emphasizing, I think, the importance of it. Because even when we do debriefs, sometimes they're really brief and they're like, hey, okay, cool. What do you think went well? You know, and then, you know, solicit feedback and then move on to address the rest of the room. But I think you really emphasized how important they are. And I think you also really emphasized how important it is for us to feel like we did everything that we could and we did it well. So like run the code well is you know, kind of what you're saying, because it's so sensitive that, you know, if we feel like we could have done more, then that's going to make it worse. So again, I love that you guys did this article. It's just such a good, tight review of things that, you know, we worry about and, you know, some pearls that we can take with us for, you know, hopefully it doesn't happen, but we know that it might, then that we will feel, you know, adequately prepared. So I want to thank you guys again for joining us and for giving all of your expert commentary.
Yeah, thank you. It was a pleasure.
That is it for us this month. That was a great review and one that hopefully helps you call on those pearls of neonatal resuscitation next time a precipitous delivery rolls through your doors. Now, the magazine is chock full of lots of features on emergency medicine practice and also lots of additional clinical content. There is chronic wound care and acute care with Dr. Levitin. There's a great review on traumatic coronary artery dissections with Dr. Hellman. There is a great debate, cefepime versus piptazo, with Dr. Radecki, and Dr. Hellman has a review on VP shunt failures. As always, tweet us if you have an idea for the podcast or for the magazine at ASAPNow, or feel free to tweet me direct at Amy Faith Ho. We would love to hear your thoughts and feedback and keep you tuning in. So thanks, y'all, and I'll see you all next time.